And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hey everybody, it's Dean Haglund here in the post-production offices in Los Feliz, California. The sunny, sunny Los Feliz, California. And this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And I'm here with your co-host, my Mr. Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen. Look at those
Hello,
levels.
Dean Haglund. What happened? I feel like your levels...
Went far, far away. But now I'm back.
A galaxy far, far away.
See what you did?
Indeed.
Indeed. There you go.
But you have actually not gone to a galaxy far, far away.
No.
You're still sitting here in Los Feliz.
Los Feliz, California. Sunny, gorgeous, chilly day in California that only Los Angeles can experience.
People there in, is it Newtown?
In Newtown, New South Wales.
They're in Sydney. Are going to be confused because they're going to think they see Dean Haglund walking around the neighborhood today.
With the Dobermans.
But no, because you're here
through the magic of podcasting
on the first installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour for 2016.
Right.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year, everybody.
How'd you celebrate?
Oh, you know what I did?
What?
I went on a paddle wheel boat harbor cruise through the Sydney Harbor and then parked directly under the bridge to watch not just one fireworks show, but the 9 p.m. and the midnight fireworks show blast me with a regalia of music and lights and flashings.
Did you enjoy it?
I think I probably did.
I love the idea that it gets canceled, right? And then everyone will know we pre-recorded this. So I rang in the new year at a Disney concert hall, which I love to do.
Yes, who's playing?
Gladys Knight.
You're kidding.
Queen of Soul, Gladys Knight.
Yes.
Yeah. Show starts at 10:30. She'll still be going when it becomes midnight.
Wow.
I love it.
Part of the Pips, too?
I always wanted to be a Pip. I still have my little childhood Pip uniform. Anyway, so very exciting.
Very exciting.
The other thing that I spent a lot of time ringing in the new year doing was reading the angry emails from listeners after our review of Star Wars Force Awakens.
Oh, yeah? How was that?
And I like that what you said, the more you think about it, the more you hate it. And, of course, as I said, I had come from such a place of hating what it means for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, it is a movie that embodies the dark side. Yes. It's about the light side, but everything about its corporateness
is the dark side.
Is the dark side.
It's,
you know,
Disney.
Right down to not letting George Lucas having any input, and yet only having a Lucasfilm logo on it. No Disney logo,
right.
Just Lucasfilm. But George Lucas, we're ignoring your story notes. is just so because dark side.
That is dark side. The one force. Yeah.
But anyway, as we talked about last week, you were thumbs down. I was thumbs up on it, even though I acknowledge that it's a dangerous thing.
Cultural road.
This movie.
Yeah.
That gets ever more dangerous. But the thing that we didn't do, and of course I'm a big advocate that you need to criticize a movie for what it is, not for what it's not.
Right.
Right now, I would like to do that. I would like to criticize it for what it's not,
okay.
If I may.
Let's
just take
do
a
that.
Moment. Because I was aware during the movie of, instead of doing basically a remake and a pastiche and using your sentimentality towards characters to create these nostalgic moments,
right?
So much of the emotion of the movie is based entirely on nostalgia.
Yeah. Right?
But... if I may.
Okay.
Is there not an interesting story if you're going to go back and explore this universe? Would not an actual story that evolves out of a stormtrooper character?
Yeah.
Who realizes, through his own crisis of conscience, where the brainwashing doesn't hold, And you learn about that whole process of how they become and yeah. all this and what they do when they have that break, when they see what they're a part of.
The fissure.
This story of one man standing up against impossible odds because he can't live with himself otherwise.
Yeah. That sounds like a great story.
Wouldn't that be a fun one to do?
The single stormtrooper. But, you know, here's the thing.
That whole story that is just used as character notes.
Yeah.
Because that's all you ever get in these movies anymore are character notes.
Yeah.
Which ignores the fact that story should come out of character.
Hello. So the idea then that, now you made me lose my train of thought, that the story should be the stormtrooper.
The stormtrooper, yeah.
And you said last week that J.J. Abrams is competent but not has no expertise,
yeah.
which is a great point. And what's great about that point is I think the idea of a single stormtrooper who's a clash of consciences is maybe already a fan film out there. And those fan films is what this thing looked like. If you've seen Pink Five, the female X-Wing fighter, or any of those other great fan films that have been made over the years, this thing, Force Awakens, looks exactly in about the same quality and the same level of storytelling as a lot of those fan films. So why not make a fan film that is even better than what this is? A story of a stormtrooper having the fissure, realizing that he's been groomed to be a part of the evil empire.
Yeah.
I'm...
Maybe you're going to do that.
I'm choking on my own rage.
How does it taste?
It's delicious.
Oh, good.
Oh, it's 2016, and there it is.
So we are in a season now where... of course, all the big box office blockbusters opened.
Yeah.
It becomes a little bit of a cinematic graveyard in terms of new releasing because in addition to competing with these big films that are going to continue to open wider, movies like The Revenant, which I saw but I'll review in the future, and Hateful Eight, and these kind of movies which are expanding because it was hard to get screens with Star Wars.
That's what...
Did you hear about Tarantino? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I haven't followed that whole story because in Australia, we weren't really getting that.
Well, Tarantino made a 70mm film in Cinerama.
Okay.
And
very few theaters can show that.
Right. And one of them is the Cinerama Dome.
Right.
Arclight Theater. So where it was supposed to open,
big.
He believed on Christmas Day as part of the road show. In 70mm with the full intermission, full extra 12 minutes, full overture. And then apparently, according to him,
right,
this has not devolved into lawsuit yet. So we won't
run the lawsuit in a week.
But Disney strong-armed to get that historic theater. And there was a time when they wouldn't be able to do this because the law was you couldn't have both the Chinese theater and the Cinerama Dome. That within a certain... There was a non-compete clause.
Non-compete clause.
But now that... Because all these chains are owned by corporations and they're all... There's non-compete clauses is out the window.
Yeah, ridiculous.
So Star Wars is... Force Awakens literally opens on... The main screen of the Chinese theater, and of course,
right.
I'm sure some of the other Chinese theater, smaller screens, but the old historic Grauman's Chinese theater,
right.
across the street at the El Capitan,
right? Somehow.
And then a few blocks down on Sunset at the Cinerama Dome.
And all of them showing the same thing.
The Force Awakens, yeah.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, none of those, no version of it would have satisfied you more than any of the others. Don't think you have to go try it out. It's not like Clue where you're going to see different endings.
Maybe there's one that ends better.
Anyway, so he was upset.
Right.
Because apparently, according to him, according to the Weinsteins, Disney...
reneged?
They said... you don't let us have
the Cinerama Dome.
Cinerama Dome. No Arclight is getting Force Awakens.
So they said,
so long, Tarantino. Now, Arclight denies, they said Tarantino and Weinstein's were always aware
that this was a possibility.
But I don't know. That seems odd.
But there would have to be a clause in a contract that says this or this cannot happen.
And you know, Tarantino did make a lot of money for Disney back in the day when the Weinsteins were at Miramax and part of Disney.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the other hand, you do have to take anything that comes out of the Weinsteins with a grain of salt. For example, them mocking the idea that anyone is offended by how misogynistic Hateful Eight is. They said, well, that's just people grasping at straws. Yeah, if the straws are the size of trees and they're trees that are misogynistic.
Yes, they were grasping at those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I haven't seen it.
So in the wake of the box office explosion, in the wake of the season of self-congratulation, where there's so many award films.
I nominate the award season.
Award-seeking films that are continuing to do business. I read with some interest an article in the Daily Beast where they published their list of the most overlooked films of the year. And I thought we could put those films to the test right here.
Very good. To see if we overlooked them.
Or if we agree that they would be what we think of as overlooked.
Right. What are the criteria of overlookedness?
The first one that they list is a movie called Absolutely. I have not heard of this.
Me neither.
So I'm already on their side of believing that this might have been overlooked.
Right. I am the very victim of the overlooked.
But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily good.
Right. Maybe it just...
It's a movie from Iran. And I say, well, you know, a foreign language film, a film from Iran, hard to get a big spotlight on it.
Totally.
But it's from Asghar Farhadi, who directed A Separation.
Oh, right.
Which was my number one film, I think, of the year that it came out just a couple years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw his follow-up. That got a big release.
Not Allowed to Make It a Film. Yeah, that one.
And
and he's the one that made a film about being stuck in his house by not allowing him to have...
No.
Is that not the same guy?
It's not the same guy.
Okay, never mind then.
No. So I would say that since this was the first I was hearing of this movie by this master of contemporary cinema... Yeah, I guess it's overlooked.
Yes. So you got to find that one. It's called Absolutely.
I've not heard of it.
And yet you are at the DGA all the time.
I'm going through these Metacritic consensus lists. I'm a voter for the Film Independent Spirit Awards.
Yes.
Never heard of it.
Good Lord.
So there you
go. There's a marketing problem.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, absolutely. There's one.
Second film, Love and Mercy. Which makes me think, huh, this is the biopic of Brian Wilson, which we talked about on this show back in summer when it came out. Paul Dano is getting award consideration, getting nominations in this for his performance as one of two actors, John Cusack being the other, who play Brian Wilson in the film. I don't know. Is this really overlooked? Yeah. People know this movie.
I guess, but maybe they didn't go, or maybe they didn't appreciate it for what it was.
Well, but now, isn't that a
different thing?
Isn't saying underappreciated a different thing than overlooked?
Well, also...
Because underappreciated means that other people didn't like it as much as I did.
Right, so you didn't chat it up and word of mouth
didn't spin, so therefore, I have to argue that it's underappreciated and argue its virtues. To say that a movie is overlooked, I think almost assumes its virtues.
Right.
And says, how come we don't know about it?
Right.
How come more people don't know about it?
This amazing film. Whereas Love and Mercy, I believe I recall people saying, it's adequate.
It does some great things. It does. But, you know, it is a biopic. It is a musical biopic. It is... I don't know. It's getting, like I said, it's getting award nominations.
Uh-huh.
It's not going to be forgotten. It's not going anywhere.
Right, right.
So on the strength of that, I don't know if I would. Now,
okay.
The third one is a very interesting case. It's Dope. Filmmaker Rick Famuyiwa's, Famuyiwa, I believe is the name, coming of age story. I would agree, was ironically overlooked by being open nationwide in June. Remember, this was the independent film that was picked up at Sundance and then released to theaters nationwide, thousands of theaters.
All of a sudden.
As counter-programming.
Do.
And it made like $6 million, which is more than what many independent films make in their entire run.
Yeah.
But because it cost so much to get it out to those theaters, that was not nearly as much as it needed to make in its opening weekend.
Damn it.
And because it was nationwide, it didn't have the opportunity to do what successful independent films do, which is to build word of mouth through platforming
releases.
So here's the irony: is it got overlooked by being everywhere,
hiding in plain sight.
Exactly. Indeed, because how would you have ever heard of it?
Yeah.
How would you know anything about it? No stars. You have no idea of what it is. They took out TV ads and things, but again, there's no familiarity to it,
right?
Because it is something new and kind of exciting. I've still not caught up to this movie.
Uh-huh.
And it got very good reviews, and
it was just a weird marketing. Again, this is all about often how marketing is an extension of the film itself.
Yeah, it so, hid in plain sight.
Right.
And as a result was overlooked.
Okay, that's an interesting case. Here's
another movie, Eden, which I guess is overlooked because this is the first time I'm hearing of it, directed by Mia Hansen-Love. So a movie that might need to be added to the list of recent female-directed films that everyone should see.
Yep.
It's a basic little synopsis. It's a vibrant film that chronicles a French DJ's journey from house parties in the 80s through to the electronic dance music boom of the 2000s. What an interesting way to chart musical changes through the story arc, the character arc of one DJ.
That is interesting. I don't know if I'd really want to see that. As you pitch it now, I'm like,
But does this not go back, Dean Haglund, to you not liking music very much?
Well, I like musicals. And I like...
You have said on this show you don't like music.
I don't like music.
Yeah, and this is a movie all about music.
Well,
yeah, and someone's love of music.
Well, maybe that's the movie I need to see. Maybe my love of music will come if I see a movie about somebody loving music for 20 years and seeing how the boom of electronica really is an expression of a DJ who doesn't just play somebody else's music and makes millions of dollars, but actually tries to create something. I know people say DJ are artists.
Critiquing the movie for what it's not already.
Exactly. It's not about a guy who's just playing other people's music to a house party.
Or it might be. I don't know. We don't know because we haven't seen it.
I know.
And we haven't seen it possibly because it's so overlooked.
Okay. So I give that one. Yeah.
Another film on the list, Tangerine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have heard of this.
Yeah.
This is currently number 12 on the Metacritic consensus list of the best films of the year.
Wow.
And I believe it's earned some Spirit Award nominations as well.
Okay.
So I think it being overlooked by virtue of critics like this saying it, and maybe some independent awards, are going to
give it some visibility.
Give it some life. Yeah. It was shot entirely on iPhones.
Oh, that thing.
It's Sean S. Baker's tale of a trans woman... sex worker scorned.
Right.
And now Caitlyn Jenner has taken up the
cause?
The standard. She's the standard bearer for this film. So indeed, people will know about it because she's got a lot of followers.
That's what she's got.
Phoenix. Here is a film currently tied for 10th on the Metacritic list. It is overlooked, even though I'd heard of the name.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been seeing it on all these lists, which is why I've heard of the name.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what it was about until reading this article. I was going to see it anyway, because I see every film on the Metacritic list.
Right.
But tell me this does not sound awesome.
Okay, here we go.
A stylish noir, as opposed to all those noirs with no style at all. Noir actually references style.
I know.
Anyway, stylish noir centering on a Holocaust survivor who returns to Berlin after undergoing facial reconstruction surgery.
Oh, I like that one. That sounds pretty cool.
Phoenix.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So it's not about a city in Arizona.
No,
it's a reference to a mythological bird
that rises from the ashes.
Yes.
How fantastic.
In the deserts of Arizona. Okay.
No, it's not the city. Sorry, wrong one.
Now, here's one that I've been hearing a lot about. Okay. So I don't know if at one point maybe it was overlooked.
Right, but you're hearing a lot about it.
Attending a screening of it through Film Independent.
Look at that.
At Arclight, but it's The Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Oh, yeah.
It's Marielle Heller's feature directorial debut, I believe. And apparently it offers one of the year's most complex and fascinating characters, Minnie, played by Belle Powley, a 15-year-old comic book artist on the cusp of womanhood who begins sleeping with her mother's boyfriend.
What? That's harsh.
So the question really is, if it is overlooked, how much longer can it be considered to be overlooked when it got a bunch of Spirit Award nominations, is on the Film Fatales list that came out last summer of female-directed films everyone should see.
Right.
And one of the stars is Kristen Wiig.
Say.
So
that seems to got a lot going for it.
Yeah, so maybe it is overlooked as of the publishing of this show.
Right.
But probably not for long.
We give it the old Chilpack Hollywood bump.
You know, I have a salve that can actually help take care of that book.
Oh, good. I didn't realize. It was contagious.
Queen of Earth. Following last year's, this is according to them,
right?
Daily Beast, following last year's underappreciated collaboration, Listen Up, Philip. Now, notice they didn't say overlooked.
Right.
Underappreciated collaboration, Listen Up, Philip. Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men fame mm-hmm. has reunited with filmmaker Alex Ross Perry mm-hmm. for this harrowing portrait of a woman mm-hmm. on the verge of a total breakdown.
Hmm.
Okay. So I watched Listen Up, Philip.
Yeah.
After receiving an email from our loyal listener, Maddie Giles.
Right. Who recommended it.
Who recommended it and was angry.
At you.
No.
No.
He was angry about the fact... I'm saying angry. He was certainly disappointed and confused why it didn't make the Metacritic consensus list of the top 30 films last year. And it was a very deep year last year.
Right.
So much so that I actually went deeper through all the lists and ended up seeing the top 40 last year, including, I think, Listen Up, Philip, which was right around 38 or 39, if the list had gone so far.
Right.
This was a movie with really good performances and really nice writing that was so poorly directed. And when I reviewed it on the show, I talked about that.
Right.
It was absolutely photographed, lensed in entirely the worst way possible for this material. The worst way possible. It wow. undid almost everything.
Wow.
And it was directed by the writer.
How?
So that might be why Queen of Earth is overlooked.
Right, because the other one was awful.
It was, not awful, but it was so poorly directed.
Right. And so that's the underappreciation?
So you see those actors, and you're aware of the script being quality, but when it's just not working, you go, I don't know if I want to see this guy's next film. So that might be why.
That might be why. Okay, good.
All right, here's one that's an absolute head-scratcher.
Okay.
Steve Jobs.
Overlooked?
And their argument is that it earned just under $18 million at the domestic box office.
So, therefore...
Tom Hanks defined what it means to be a movie star nowadays. I mean, he literally actually gave a definition.
Oh, he did.
I think it was around the time Charlie Wilson's War came out.
Okay.
And because they asked, you know, they said to him, you know, that it had been a spotty decade. And he said, like, people like him and Harrison Ford, you know, in the 2000s, because when was Charlie Wilson's War? Around 2007, 2008? They were saying, you know, you haven't had these big hits like you both did in the 90s. Would you still consider yourself a movie star? I thought that was a bold question to ask the person sitting there.
Yeah.
But his definition of a movie star in the contemporary age was, do you know about the film coming out?
Right.
If you know about it coming out, then probably it's because it's got a movie star in it.
Right.
Do you know about it being a hit? Or do you know about it being a flop?
Right.
If these things are being reported, it's probably because you're a movie star. That's the definition of it.
Right.
That if it's a success or a failure, you know about it and you read about it means because, it had a movie star in it.
Right.
Because if it didn't have a movie star in it and it was a flop, people would go, well, it didn't have any stars in it.
Right.
It's not news.
It's not news.
Right. It's only news if it had no stars in it and it was a huge hit.
Right.
It's the hit with no stars.
It's amazing.
But the flop with no stars is just a movie with no stars.
Right. It's 800 movies that are made every year.
So
Steve Jobs.
So to say that it's overlooked because it only made $18 million, look, it's getting award nominations.
Yes.
It got good reviews. Everyone knows about it. It's based on a super famous household name.
Yes.
Based on a best-selling book.
Right.
If people aren't interested in the subject matter,
it's not an overlooked thing.
Yeah, they know about it.
Right. It's I don't want to see it. It's not selling off the log line, as they say.
Yeah.
If your log line, hey, it's the life of Steve Jobs. You want to see that? No, not really. Like Bridge of Spies.
Maybe it's the approach to it, too. Maybe that brilliant structure that Aaron Sorkin came up with in saying we're going to condense this book down into three product launches and it really becomes this play, which absolutely was responsible for so much of what works in that movie.
Yeah.
But maybe that approach is not what someone wants. If I want a Steve Jobs movie, I want it to be about his coming of age.
The power.
Yeah, the rise.
Yeah, yeah.
And absolutely. How did they come up with this stuff?
Yeah.
But everyone knows about it. So no. I have a hard time saying it's overlooked.
Yeah, I'm not
that kidding. Would absolutely be a case of maybe you can argue it's underappreciated.
Yeah.
But is
even
it?
Then?
Because it got great reviews and it's getting award nominations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So somebody appreciated it. It's just I don't want to see it.
Yeah.
Because I'm...
And $18 million is not a small amount of money and people are going to keep seeing it through the years.
Right.
If it's cost versus its margin is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, that's a different subject than is it overlooked? That's, well, was it a smart business decision?
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's a different deal.
Okay. And finally, The Assassin. from Taiwanese master Hao Shao Shen.
Yes.
It transports you to 8th. Is it 8th China? 8th century China?
8th century China, yeah.
As it follows Nick Yinyang.
Uh-huh.
A female assassin who's tasked with traveling to a remote land to murder its ruler, a man she had been set to marry.
No.
So, Dean Haglund, this female action-driven picture in a historic context.
Yes, true story.
Bringing some genre elements that are loved, which are, you know, the martial arts and the sword play of Asian cinema.
Right.
And it is currently number 8 on the Metacritic list of the best films of the year. So at this point, again, something that's overlooked, but I would imagine, I don't know if it's eligible or if it made the short list. I probably should have looked this up for the foreign language film.
Maybe.
But if it did, that could be the sort of thing that turns the tipping point.
Why I know that's not overlooked, because it's playing at my movie theater in Sydney, and I was planning to go see it as soon as possible.
But that reveals your provincial context, as opposed to this person's provincial context, that a film is overlooked. But, of course, this is an American writer.
All right.
Overlooked in America.
All right. So, yes.
Which does, in fairness, often have an impact on what films are known about around the world.
True.
If a film from another country does well in America, has high visibility here, it's assured a much larger global reach.
Absolutely. I suggest The Last Cab to Darwin is an overlooked film here in America because it's a lovely story of taking a cab to Darwin, Australia. You know, so did that play here? Did you see Last Cab to Darwin?
No.
See, there's a lovely, fun story.
You might have at least one film on your top 10 list.
Yeah, finally.
And indeed, you know, this is the first show of the new year.
Right.
It's not the traditional show that we usually do of our New Year's resolutions. I'll look back at last year's resolutions, holding our feet to the fire and resolving to move forward with certain intentions.
A new resolution.
Just born. We will do that on next week's show.
Okay, good.
And then, if I'm doing the math correctly, on the 18th, we do a very exciting thing. We'll do other things as well. But one of the things that we'll do is talk about the worst movies, because we don't like to deal strictly in the positive.
Never.
So we'll talk about some of the worst movies of the year. And then, of course, shortly on the heels of that, we will be giving our list of the best films. But at the same time, we also have a certain revival of The X-Files that we need to cover.
That's going to be a big deal.
We've got new Dean Hagland live comedy show that's debuting this year. So a lot to cover. This is an exciting month at your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
It certainly is.
We had a couple of emails that we'll get to, yep. But I thought I would mention two, again, award hopeful films that were released before the end of the year.
Okay.
That I saw.
And enjoyed?
I certainly saw them. There's no denying that.
Ow, already. Air chilled.
One from Nicholas Heitner.
Okay.
Based on a play that Lily actually saw in the West End more than 10 years ago.
Okay.
15 years ago, even, with the same star, called The Lady in the Van. And and this is about a homeless woman who gets help pushing her van into the driveway of acclaimed playwright Alan Bennett. And she lives out the rest of her days there in that van.
Got it.
And Maggie Smith played the homeless woman.
Love it.
And it's an exploration of what led her there. And, you know, apparently the play was expressed largely a two-hander.
Yes.
And through monologues.
Okay.
And supposedly a brilliant, not an easy play.
No.
As an audience member, a challenging play. But brilliant and worth the effort and really, you know, emotionally moving, and insightful.
Okay.
So it's a bold choice on the part of filmmaker Nicholas Heitner and his collaborators to so many years later, take this, rich and complex, play and turn it into just a deathly uninteresting film. That is a bold choice. Not bold. The choice I would have made.
How to make this deathly uninteresting? How can I do this?
But I don't want to criticize the movie for what it's not, i.e.
anything.
At any turn an interesting film.
Oh, no.
I want to take it for what it is, which is a movie where every decision is made for you, where every challenge is taken away from the audience through the director just putting it in your face, making a choice and putting it in your face. Or even the performers, there are still monologues, but now one of the long-running monologues is between the character of Alan Bennett, who wrote it, and how he is of two minds, the person who writes for a living and the person who has to walk through the world.
Right.
On screen, what do? We have that actor play two characters. The same guy who appears via split screen and interacts with himself for a god-awful portion of the movie.
Oh, no.
Add to that the fact that really that actor, if I never see him again, it'll be too soon. He's gifted, but he just got on my last nerve.
Oh, my God.
As John Saxon once said about John Malkovich... Yeah, he's good. He's good. There's something about him that just makes me want to punch his face in. So this was kind of the feeling that I had during this. So that's a personal aside of it not working. But the choice of having this actor, of making these monologues be like this.
And Maggie Smith is the
woman. Maggie Smith, her performance is, you know, it's quick bits. And always played for the cutes. Always played for the joke. Always played. There is no authenticity to this woman being homeless. And at times when she seems to be going to it as a performer, the whole scene is so constructed around visual gags.
Oh, no.
That it's undermined.
So it's hot fuzz, basically.
And it's getting great reviews.
Ah, no.
Yeah, because it means well and it's got cute Maggie Smith and a cutesy old person performance.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Can't run fast enough.
Now a movie getting surprisingly not good reviews.
That you probably liked?
I certainly saw it.
Okay.
Mixed reviews, let's say.
Let's say that.
Is the third now collaboration between writer-director David O. Russell and his stars Jennifer Lawrence, Bradley Cooper, and Robert De Niro.
Right.
And this is Joy.
Joy.
The true story of a working class single mom supporting her family, supporting her parents through her, her various jobs, who was able to find financial independence, but also liberation through an invention, initially an invention that she made of a mop that sold on QVC, sold record-breaking numbers, and altered the way that home shopping was done on television.
Right.
And this woman has gone on to, you know, invent hundreds of patents and now bring other people's inventions. To, somebody should have taken Chilpack to her, quite frankly, back then. That was the woman who would have done it. You could have gone on the show. I mean, oh, my God.
We did try to get on QVC.
Dogged, but she could have gotten you there. You had to meet with her. As you find out, she meets one-on-one with the inventor and finds out what inspired you to come up with this.
Right.
And if she's moved by the story and she thinks you'll be good on TV, that's it.
Good Lord. Why? How did I not get...
Home Shopping Network, because she partnered with Barry Diller on Home Shopping Network. Anyway...
Damn it.
So, can David O. Russell make a bad film? Well, he made I Heart Huckabees. Some people enjoy that, though. Yeah. You know, his... He's one of those cases that you'll hear me say from time to time... And it stretches credulity a little bit. But you've heard me say that, you know, a great filmmaker's bad films are more interesting than a mediocre filmmaker's successes.
Right.
Right? They're still informative, and you still learn from their failures.
Absolutely.
And their ambition is such that, sometimes a man's reach should exceed his grasp.
And you should see a failure, too, or you're not taking a risk as an artist.
Right, and that might also be what informs the successes later on.
Absolutely.
This film has some structural problems to it in terms of the story. But the biggest problem is also its greatest strength. And I wonder if this is the reason that there's some, not antipathy, what's ambivalence?
Ambivalence.
On the part of critics.
Huh.
Which is, its strength is another just knock down, you are everything performance from Jennifer Lawrence.
Right on.
She's fantastic.
Great.
And miscast.
What?
Because there's a component that's really missing to this.
Okay.
Jennifer Lawrence, it's not that we don't believe her in this blue-collar, struggling performance. Yeah, you look at her, and she's every bit the movie star. She's Jennifer Lawrence. But sure. David O. Russell gives us enough time, and unlike the director of Lady in the Van, gives her the room to embody the character and explore the character through long enough takes where we see that it's Jennifer Lawrence doing the work. We see, boy, I know that this is the biggest movie star on the planet, but I believe that these are her crying, throwing up children.
Right, right.
I believe that, you know.
Yeah, how does that happen?
And you have to allow movie stars to have the time to be able to do that if you want us to be moved by it and take it seriously.
Right.
Certain kind of films, comedies, action films, maybe you feel like you don't need to take that time.
Right.
But if you really want to deeply connect with it, you do. The problem is, though...
And here we go.
...that the woman who did this was 35, 36 when the key events happen. When her mother says to her, her grandmother says to her, you know, I used to think everything was possible for you when your whole life was ahead of you. Your whole life's no longer ahead of you, but a good portion of it still is.
Right.
That's her pep talk. Saying that to Jennifer Lawrence, who is 23?
Yeah.
I think she's 23 because she broke big early. Remember Winter's Bone?
Winter's Bone.
She was so young.
Yeah.
So it's not only that it's Jennifer Lawrence. And it's not only how Jennifer Lawrence looks and all she has going for her, but it's also the fact that she's so young.
See?
And this movie, the story that this movie is based on could very much, and I hate throwing this word around, but it could very much be an important story. Because how many, let's just say women at 35, 36 years of age could use a story that reminds them that anything is still possible for you.
Right. You still have your life ahead of you. You're not thrown on the trash bin.
Remember when we remembered and celebrated Maya Angelou, and I was struck by, in her biography, that, you know, our poet laureate, who will go down in history as one of the most famous poets, one of the best poets America ever produced, had never, you know, written poetry until her 40s.
Yeah.
She'd had many other careers before that.
Yeah.
Right? But this is what we remember her for. Yeah. So this idea that you have to know it in the 20s, you have to be mastering it in the 30s, all this stuff, it's wrong.
Wrong.
Wrong. Yeah, there is no expiration date for these things.
Right.
So
to have a movie where you cast somebody at 23 playing a 35 to do the story, yeah, to be the epic.
It doesn't resonate.
Right.
And I think that even though critics haven't hit the nail on the head with it, I think that's its biggest problem.
Wow. So is this the ageism again that we suffer here in Hollywood? Of the idea that...
I wouldn't place that on David O. Russell. I would say every director ought to be able to cast who they think is right for it.
Right.
And why does a director come to a piece in the first place? Sometimes it's because they're inspired about working with a certain performer.
Right.
He clearly loves working with Jennifer Lawrence, and in fairness, gives her great, well-developed roles. And she's terrific in all of them.
Sounds great.
Right? She was the best part of that Khan movie. What was the one again?
American Hustle.
American Hustle.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, her performance in that was such a more authentic and meaningful depiction of bipolar disorder than it was in the movie that she did with David O. Russell about bipolar
disorder.
Silver
Lining, yeah, playbook.
And that sounds like a mean thing to say, but it's understandable. Because when you make a movie about an illness versus making a movie where the story comes out of characters, but one of these characters happens to live with this.
Right, and has that.
That gives you much more of a sense of what it's like.
Yes.
Because nobody lives their life. Their life isn't about
a disease.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, in certain cases, it will be for certain times, but the objective is to live a life with the disease.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, the point is he does great work with her, and he loves working with her. More power to him. That's terrific. It's just, this was a wrong choice of material for that collaboration. And she's great in it,
yeah,
again, but it's missing out. And so when we saw it, was thinking, well, who could have been cast?
Well, this is my next question.
Because if you think that it has to be a movie star, well then, so I go home and I watch the final episode of Fargo. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, Kirsten Dunst is 35 now.
Oh,
so great in Fargo.
Yeah.
And I'm watching her in Fargo and I'm thinking, this is the woman.
She's standing right there.
That's perfect. She's already in a period look right now.
Yeah.
You know, fantastic. But we've lost sight of the fact that she was once a movie star.
Right.
How about her co-star in the movie Dick, that parody of All the President's Men
from
the 90s, which I really... continue to treasure, where Will Ferrell played, oh my goodness, not Carl Bernstein, but...
Woodward.
Woodward. We're playing Password now.
Yeah.
you are correct.
You're
15
correct.
Points for Gene Haglund.
Ding, 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 ding.
Okay, Jamie Farr's team. Anyway.
Pass. I'll pass.
But Michelle Williams. Multiple Oscar nominee now, Michelle Williams.
Yeah.
Why not her?
Why not her?
Playing this. She would have been... perfect. So there are those choices out there. And that's why joy is undermined by casting. But again, how sometimes the greatest strength of a piece can also be the weakness.
So funny. So I'm looking at Fuzz. He's trapped under...
She. Fuzz is a girl.
She's trapped
not
under...
Not trapped. She's buried herself under some blankets because it is cold, but she wants us to know where she is.
Oh, is that why she's...
So
I thought that was the cry of help. I don't know how to get the hell out of here.
No, it's the cry of please pay attention to me. Because the risk of burying yourself under that is we might not know where she is.
That giant lump under the blanket.
Don't call her a lump.
I meant the...
How dare you?
why I should leave the building.
So we're going to be a few weeks behind on the Film Fatales list by the time we return to it. But please, no one send angry emails to Dean about this. We've just got a lot on our agenda, but 2016 is a year where we really look forward to celebrating female directors, so much so that this is not written in stone and might even be news to her. Mm-hmm. But I met in New York with one of Leah Meyerhoff's collaborators and good friends. A friend of mine, Joe Pacheco, very talented Renaissance man. And Leah Meyerhoff, I mentioned to you recently because she directed I Believe in Unicorns, one of the movies off the Film Fatales list. And I don't know if I mentioned it, but in addition, that was the coming-of-age story, where I admitted like coming-of-age stories are kind of my least favorite genre, and I found myself really enjoying this all because of her direction.
Fantastic.
And I told Joe this, I would love to see her direct a play. There was something about this movie that made me think, boy, what she could do on stage,
live theater.
I would love. And he told me that he thinks that she's done some small pieces, but never anything big. I would love it. I might even try to make that happen. But anyway, we'll talk about that with Leah Meyerhoff.
What?
When we have her as a guest on the show.
Shut up.
Because he's going to make that happen for us. Because in addition to directing one of the films on the list, according to Film Fatales, of recent female-directed films everyone should see, she's the founder of Film Fatales.
What?
Which is an organization not only now in 15 cities, but that is now splitting between Film Fatales for feature films and Film Fatales for short films.
Look at that. How did you swing that deal?
So this is one of the interviews I'm most excited by, and I can't wait. So that is our mea culpa for not getting to a female-directed film this week. But we had emails that I'd wanted to get to last week.
Right.
And we should get to it now.
Yeah.
Dear Dean and Phil.
Hey, that's us.
Or perhaps I should say Phil and Dean, since it was Phil who prompted this email. Oh God, what did I do wrong this time? It is impossible not to note the numerous occasions on which the Chill Pack duo, primarily Mr. Lairness, have wondered what the impact would/will be of women in full combat roles in the U.S. military.
Right.
Now, this has been a recent thing. I became aware of how your vision of the future, where, as you always said, if you've got an action film and you don't have a female lead in it, don't bother. Hey, Star Wars, Force Awakens picks up on this.
They
understand that.
They
totally
get it.
We talked about how much of the emotional heft is relying on nostalgia, which is cheap and destructive and dangerous.
And tawdry.
But for me, there was an emotional pull to the fact of this woman. I didn't quite understand the character that she was playing. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really gave her much of a character to play.
I agree.
But she played an emotional reality.
Absolutely.
She did as an actor, I think, the best you can do, which is she embodied an energy and she combined it with an emotional reality.
Yeah.
Did she go into the deep layers of making the material be about what the character isn't saying and knowing why the character isn't saying it? No, because I don't think she was given that material.
Right.
But anyway, here's another movie. And we talked about Mad Max Fury Road. So many of these. So this is what inspired me to say, wow, the future is here.
Right.
So now what is this saying about the mirror? What is this mirror showing us about the psychological reality of the American public right now?
Right.
It means that we have accepted women as equal warriors to men. So when they become that in combat, and by the way, of course, that recently was put into action, that now they are, every combat job is open to them in equal numbers.
Right.
And of course, you got to think in greater numbers because there's more women than men.
Right.
And if you want to maintain, because apparently, according to the recent presidential debates I saw, we're at war. And we're always going to be at war. We're never going to stop being at war, apparently. What about climate change and Glass-Steagall and Wall Street?
Yeah.
Look, can we deal with threats first and then deal with the unimportant stuff? Yeah, how's that been going? Hasn't there always been a threat?
Yeah.
Anyway. Soapbox gets put away.
Back to the letter.
So what would it mean? when this happens culturally, because we might get to the point of war not being as palatable when the bodies being returned to us are our sisters, daughters, and mothers.
Right.
Right? So, in fact, according to this listener, the question has been asked so many times it began to occupy my mind during the more tedious parts of my day.
Yeah.
Less seeking an answer than wanting to understand the question, I pondered Phil's recurring query.
Nah.
After all, women are required to do the same compulsory service in the Israeli army as their male counterparts, with no observable decrease in military aggression. True. Now, I cannot speak as an authority on the Israeli security situation.
Okay.
I cannot.
Right.
I don't think you can, and honestly, I don't believe that American foreign policy experts can. You know why? Because we're not them.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not there.
We're right? not so, there, you don't
so,
see it.
So this is a context on which I am not familiar.
Very.
But I do know that people are willing to sign off on things that maybe belie their heartfelt desires, such as their heartfelt desires for peace.
Right.
When they perceive a significant threat.
Right.
Right. Peace cannot happen until this threat is put down.
Right.
This leads to a very dangerous way of thinking that we can combat violence by violence.
Yes.
And peace will win.
Somehow.
No, it seems like violence has won.
Yes.
Right.
Did not we learn something from
We've
Gandhi?
We've proven that violence is a good idea, right?
Right, well... Right?
War is not the answer. Well, it depends on the question. What's good for business? Well, war. Okay.
Okay.
So anyway, but I do know that psychologically in the makeup of our people, our perceived threats, and I'm not saying they're not actual threats.
Right.
But whether a threat is actual or not, its impact in terms of how we behave individually,
right,
is entirely determined by our perception of it.
Right,
our perception dictates our behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, the threat might be real, but if we don't perceive it, we ignore it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right,
right. Yes, exactly.
Welcome to Wall Street in 2007.
We didn't. Yeah, nobody perceived it, and then.
So,
attacked.
And now it's coming again.
Now it's coming again.
Because we'll never make the same mistakes. History, what's that saying about once history happens, it never repeats itself. Okay. Meanwhile, something that isn't a threat, if you perceive it as a threat, not only is it a threat, but you might turn it into a real one.
Right.
Right?
You manifest it.
If there's a stranger who means me no harm, but I perceive this person for whatever reason, cultural, psychological, pheromones, whatever. It is that can trigger, or this person reminds me of someone that I don't remember who did something wrong to me, right? Whatever right. the thing is, if I perceive them as hostile and threatening, that perception is everything.
Right.
And the way I react to them, guess what? Might turn them into someone hostile and threatening.
Right, exactly. You will lead to hostility.
And they were just here for a cup of coffee and a small sandwich.
That's all they wanted.
But we're all out of coffee and sandwiches. So but. Now there's a fight. That's the most interesting analogy of 2016.
So far.
So that said, the perception, wow, the show's almost over. Perception of threats living in Israel, where your perceived and historic enemies are literally surrounding you.
Right.
Is certainly a different psychological impact. Right?
Right. Yeah, for
so,
females in combat.
So to have the women in equal numbers there fighting side by side and doing their compulsory service is, that's a huge difference.
It is.
On the level of aggressiveness. But secondly, compulsory service. No one's getting a draft put through. There will be no compulsory service ever again.
Yeah, right.
In America. Yeah. I mean, because there will never be that kind of war ever again.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
It's going to be terrorist wars.
And
there's
robots.
Not a declaration of war. Yeah, right. So we're never going to have compulsory service.
Yeah.
So it will not be the same.
It will be volunteer.
And then there was a third psychological difference. that's escaping me at the moment. But also population size is part of it.
Absolutely.
Population size there, again, needing to cull equally from men and women.
Yeah, absolutely. So I get it. And they've also been doing it much longer. So there's multiple generations that have gone through. I think the first generation, particularly, that sees female combats fighting side by side will feel that first reverberation ripple through society.
Historically, among people like the Scythians and more recently my own tribe, the Comanches, women regularly fought beside men, not merely defensively, but offensively, conducting raids and waging aggressive war. Now, again, in terms of the warfare of it, I can't make any direct contextual comparisons.
Right.
The letter goes on, because historians have been quick to dismiss tales of women warriors as myths or flukes, it is easy to imagine that male aggression is the norm and female aggression, therefore, necessarily aberrant or in some way unusual. It is not. The email goes on and is lengthy and is fascinating, but we've got to the gist of it.
Yeah.
And it also allows for a little bit of a conversation turn. Indeed, this listener is so accurate in saying how this feminine aggressiveness is depicted, is faulty.
Right.
But it serves in our culture, in the industrialized North, as I like to call it, of Europe and America, white cultures. It serves to uphold a certain power dynamic and power structure. And it's fascinating because, as you know, having done violence prevention work and especially focusing on sexual violence, abuse, and assaults,
yep.
People always say, well, can you ever really have a culture where there is no sexual violence? Yes, yeah. Historically you can.
Yeah,
and you know what cultures they are? They're ones where the women warriors are given equal status to their males.
Fascinating.
So
the power structure is equal.
So here's another possible change that certainly is one I would love to see.
Yeah.
Women in the military, in the U.S. as we know, to an appallingly staggering degree, are exponentially more likely to be the victims of sexual assault.
Right.
And it's at the hands of their fellow service people,
right.
Often their superiors. These are not enemies.
Yeah, yeah.
We can't keep women in service right now safe, sexually and physically, from their fellow soldiers and their senior officers. But a society that accepts psychologically women as equal warriors to men,
right?
These societies don't have those kind of problems.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Where the female aggressiveness, where there is that true equality,
you don't see it.
That, because what is any kind of violence, but especially sexual violence? It's not
power.
About sex. It's about powerlessness.
Right.
It's about trying to control someone else through the power that we know we have.
Right.
Well, if you're raised in a society where women have every bit that power you do, oh, okay.
You're not going to be able to express
yeah.
it like that.
Yeah. And also then you don't have really the feelings of powerlessness in the first place.
Right.
Because the truth is men will never feel empowered unless their female counterparts are equally empowered.
Absolutely.
None of us will be free until all of us are free. This is not just a slogan on a bumper sticker or my new t-shirt that I'll be wearing to Broadway shows since I can't wear a suit anymore.
Right. T-shirt only.
It is a psychological truism.
Wow.
Right. Anyway, the email ends. Yours in Chilpak, Wayodi. P.S., have you considered for your viewing a silent film, long considered lost and newly available on Netflix, Daughter of Dawn?
No.
It was made in 1920 by an independent filmmaker and starred an all-native cast of Kiowas and Comanches who supplied all their own props and wardrobe. Many of these cultural items were banned by the U.S. government and were brought out of hiding for use in the film.
Wow.
Most of the actors engaged in open war with the white invaders at earlier points in their lives, and the majority were avid fans of the emerging art of cinema.
Wow. The daughters of, what was it called? The gods of daughters?
It was Daughter of Dawn.
Daughter
it's
of
on
Dawn.
Netflix.
On Netflix. I'm hoping it's on my Australian Netflix, but Daughter of Dawn. I'm writing that down.
And finally, we'll close with a very brief second email. Hi, guys. You are the bomb.
Hooray.
Thanks so much for reading my email last week. I was laughing so hard at your takes on it. I was crying. Phil, no offense taken about the abusive relationship reference. You were bang on the money. It is called viewer abuse. Great analogy. This was when we were talking about, was the series Supernatural?
Yeah.
And I said that that viewers of that show are in an abusive relationship. And we're laughing about it. Isn't it right. funny? Violence. Yeah. And no, I meant people should not. I'm glad that it was an effective analogy.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't ever want to be making light of how difficult it is for people to really get out of actually
an abusive relationship.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I'm glad that at least the person who wrote us thought it was inappropriate and said it is cyclical, like relationship abuse. And I couldn't leave her relationship with Supernatural because I thought it was going somewhere.
Yes.
Like Dean inferred, it would draw you in and spit you out once a story arc completed, and I got sucked into watching another friggin' season of arcs never really patching together. just so you know.
Wow.
Anyway, a classic marker. Oh, and this person wrote, just so you know, Sam and Dean say sorry a lot in this series, which, as I said, the abuser often will apologize. And you know why? Because they mean it.
They really are.
That's one of the reasons people will stay. Anyway, it's a classic marker of an abusive relationship.
Wow.
I am sorry to hear about your technical problems on a recent show, and I'm glad it got fixed. Yep. I can hardly wait to hear your reviews on Star Wars.
Uh-oh.
And the Western that was hinted at. Of course, we got to those on recent shows.
Yep.
Talk soon. Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour fan, Mayo. Thank you for this email. We love getting them.
We should.
Please write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Find so many shows.
All the shows.
All the shows. You can find them all at chillpackhollywood.com. You can
download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review on iTunes. That's really fun.
What could be more fun?
You can go to facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Like us. When you're busy poking things on Facebook, like us.
Like us there. And follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. What else?
I will. That's it.
Okay, yeah, that's it. That's all the things you need to know.
Thanks for joining us. Happy 2016, everyone. We'll be back next week with our New Year's resolution installment.
Hooray!
The most depressing hour of the year.
No, it's fulfilling. Oh, well.
All right.
See
Happy
ya.
New Year, Dean.
A Happy New Year, Phil.
Belated spoiler alert.